Tom Wicker spent his early career as a journalist editing and reporting for a series of newspapers in the South. In 1960, he joined the New York Times as a national political reporter. It was part of the press entourage that covered President Kennedy's visit to Dallas on November 22, 1963. Wicker's coverage of the Kennedy assassination for the Times helped establish his national reputation and is still the subject of journalism school courses. A year later, he became the New York Times Washington bureau chief. Tom Wicker has written his op-ed page column for the New York Times since 1966. It's called In the Nation. It's now nationally syndicated. He's been an associate editor of the Times since 1968. His nonfiction books include Kennedy Without Tears, JFK and LBJ, The Influence of Personality Upon Politics, A Time to Die, an account of the Attica prison uprising of 1971, and On Press, which is subtitled A Top Reporter's Life in and Reflections on American Journalism. Wicker has also written 8 novels. His latest, Unto This Hour, documents the 2-day-long second battle of the Bull Run, in which Confederate General Stonewall Jackson met Union General John Pope. Tom Wicker says that his interest in the Civil War dates back to the stories his grandmother told him about her childhood in the Confederacy. He plans a sequel to Unto This Hour. Tom Wicker, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Why are you interested in doing a historical novel set during the Civil War? It's obviously, I know you researched the novel for about 5 years, so I know that the period
Not really 5 years. I spent about 5 years altogether on it, and during which time I was both writing and researching, and about a year that was research entirely, reading, you know. Well, there are several reasons why I wanted to do that, most of which are personal. As you said, when I was born in 1926, and the Civil War was very much of a presence in the South at that time. I was born in North Carolina, and I grew up with that that presence all around me. And there were so many things in the South at that time that were literally directly connected to the Civil War. The period of racial segregation, so much of the poverty that we had at that time, and the general attitude of people, the isolation, the distinctiveness of the South. Much greater then than now, all stem from the Civil War. In fact, you can say right to this day what we now call the Sun Belt, which is a very prosperous economic region. All that's in a sense the South's revenge for the Civil War, because when Northern manufacturers began to look for low-wage markets and an escape from labor unions, they found it in a South that hadn't really changed very much since the Civil War. It was a real influence on my life, and I grew up as something of a, I suppose one would say, a dilettante student of the Civil War. I read a lot about it, read most of the principal works and so forth. And as far back as I can remember, wanting to write, which is as far back as I can remember, I wanted to write about the Civil War, and I always intended it to be fiction. Later on, when I was working for the New York Times in Washington, I bought an old piece of property out in Virginia for a weekend place, and I discovered out in the back road near there, a historical marker that Jackson's army had passed on along this back road on the way to the second Battle of Bull Run. And that intrigued me very much. And the Manassas battlefields are just outside Washington, as you know. They were between Washington and my weekend place. So I knew the ground pretty well. So I had those personal reasons for wanting to do it. The second Battle of Bull Run, or Manassas, it's a very interesting battle tactically and strategically. It was a Southern victory that, in my judgment, marked the high water mark of the Confederacy, both politically and economically, because after the victory at Second Manassas in August of 1862, General Lee immediately launched on his first invasion of the North, crossed the Potomac, I believe, on September the 1st, 1862. And carried with him, I think, the best prospects the Confederacy ever had, both militarily, because they were hoping to detach Maryland from the Union, which would have caused the fall of Washington. And had that happened, they certainly could have hoped very realistically for recognition from the British or the French or both, which would have, of course, changed things drastically. As it turned out, however, the invasion was turned back on September the 17th at the Battle of Sharpsburg, or Antietam Creek, as many people know it, and everything was downhill from there on out for the South. Immediately after Antietam, President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which changed the character of the war, foreclosed the likelihood of British and French intervention. So the battle I'm writing about has importance in the scheme of things there. And then finally, I am deeply interested in history in general. I think Americans are not conscious enough of their history. I think all too many of us tend to think that the world began when we did, or at least when our parents did. And I think that pervasive sense on the part of so many Americans, that sense of having no identity, of rootlessness, of not really being anchored to anything, that it seems to me is pervasive in modern American life. I think a lot of that is because we don't either know or appreciate our past. Our past, after all, is our identity. That's where we came from. Faulkner, of course, the great icon in my part of the country for writers, Faulkner said that, the past is not dead, it's not even past. And that's true, I think.
America, when it has gone to war with other countries, has ended the war always feeling that it was definitely on the right side. And you know, Americans have never had to deal with being on the wrong side in a war in the past. Not in a major war. But with the South, I wonder, growing up in the South, if you've ever had to personally reckon with what the South stood for during the Civil War and, you know, what that means to you personally.
Well, I think people began to have to come to grips with that during the Civil Rights Movement, which began really after World War II. And
I just feel this need to amend what I was saying, because I think of World War I and World War II and not of the Vietnam War, whose statement I was making was
Vietnam wound certainly was the third largest foreign war we ever fought.
Right.
And actually, I think it probably, by most standards of measurement, would be larger than our participation in World War I. However, I understood your question. I think Southerners began to have to come to grips with that to a considerable extent after the Civil Rights Movement began. When I was growing up, as I said, I was born in 1926. We in North Carolina, at least, in my part of North Carolina, we weren't too conscious of that, because while we certainly had a very rigid system of racial segregation, still, it wasn't like some parts of the South where lynchings were common, or that there was really a brutal relationship back and forth. The blacks were certainly in a position of great disadvantage. I don't mean to deny that at all. But actually, relationships, as I recall them, between whites and blacks were really rather rather friendly. They were distant, and they certainly weren't on any equal plane or anything of that sort, but it wasn't a relationship of hostility by and large, you know. And so growing up with segregation, it was the air you breathed, you know. If you went to the movies, and in those days we went to the movies five or six times a week, if you went to the movies, the blacks were in the balcony over here. You could hear their feet up there. You wouldn't see them. You went to different schools. They were never in the places of public accommodation and so forth. So growing up as a boy, all of that just seemed as natural to me as the grass growing. Now, when the Civil Rights Movement came along, of course, I was awakened to that very early. But for that reason, I think that in those years in the 30s and along in the early 40s, we never really thought of the South as having had fought for a bad cause. You know, I mean, you knew that in a sense they fought for slavery, but you nearly like to talk about states' rights and so forth. And in any case, after the Civil War, students of the history of that period of the late 19th century have established that precisely because the South lost the war, and didn't merely lose the war in the sense of being the vanquished, but, I mean, they lost everything. So many people did. They lost property. They lost wealth. They lost husbands, fathers, sons, people who in 1859, 1860 had perfectly good cause to think that long and prosperous lives stretched before them, found themselves, in fact, spending the rest of their lives, perhaps 30, 40 years, in poverty and without any of the advantages that it had before them. So it was a devastating experience. And as a consequence of that, the South almost consciously fashioned what became known, capital L, capital C, as the Lost Cause. And it was a form of glorification of the Civil War, glorification of the great cause for which we fought, which was never slavery, of course. It was constitutional purity and glorification on better grounds of our glorious men who fought the great battle. And though outnumbered and outgunned and outmanned at every turn, nevertheless wrote one of the great stories, you know, all that, the whole Lost Cause religion. And it was very much a religion. And when I was growing up, it was still a pretty strong religion. We had Confederate Memorial Day, and our schools closed on Confederate Memorial Day, and not on the other Memorial Day. But to go on. Then, as the civil rights movement really forced the racial situation into everybody's consciousness, someone as young as I, from a very early time, by the time of the civil of the school desegregation decision in 1954, let's see, by then I would have been 28 years old, something like that. You know, I was thoroughly in favor of the civil rights movement, thoroughly convinced that it was right, thoroughly on the side of the blacks and almost anything that came along in terms of our southern segregation situation. There was a long fight still ahead. But I don't think when I was growing up, people were just not very conscious of that. I mean, segregation by then was a system that was a half century old, and it was just it was the way things were.
Just curious, you know, coming up north with a southern accent, did people, when you were breaking into journalism in the north, look at you funny when they realized that you were from the south and that, you know, you hadn't bothered to try to lose that southern accent?
Yeah. Well, I've never really, I wrote in one of my novels, Facing the Lion, some years back, I had a character in there who was had somewhat the same history as I do, you know, a southern newspaper man who'd come north, and I had gave him cause to say or think that he really thought his southern accent was an asset because it caused people to underestimate him. And there's certain truth in that because at least in those years, a lot of people tended to look upon anybody from the South as a hillbilly or a buffoon or more often a bigot. Sometimes you wouldn't be taken seriously. That's true. And as I say, I felt many times underestimated by that. And I've had the experience, not in recent years, but I'm talking about a long time ago when, perhaps I would speak somewhere or appear in a program like this or whatever. People would come to me and say afterward in tones of wonderment, "Well, I had no idea you were a Southerner," because they'd been reading my articles in the paper and they just couldn't connect that with being Southern, you know. Actually, the New York Times then and now, but then in particular, was full of Southerners. Our executive editor at the time was Turner Catledge from Philadelphia, Mississippi, of evil fame.
My guest is Tom Wicker, if you're just joining us, associate editor of the New York Times, syndicated columnist. His latest novel, Unto This Hour, is set during the Civil War. Nowadays, when we fight wars, there's the question of germ warfare, will nuclear weapons be used, and these have raised a whole new set of ethical questions. But there was a new technology in guns being used during the Civil War, too. What was the new technology, and did that bring ethical questions that hadn't been addressed before in war?
Well, yes, not only were there new technologies, but new attitudes towards war. The Civil War was the first war anywhere, not just in this country, of course, but anywhere where troops were carried to the battlefield by railroad, which, of course, made a big difference. It was the first war, I won't say the first, no, I think it was the first war in which, anywhere in which communications were greatly enhanced by the use of the telegraph. The North even had a measure of air power, as you know. They used hot air balloons for observation. Towards the end of the war, the North had available to it, although I don't think it was used very widely, they had the Gatling gun, which is the first automatic weapon, revolving barrels. Very widely in use by the Northern armies in the last year or 2 years of the war was the breech-loading rifle, which was a great advance over the muzzle loader because it would enable you to reload so quickly. But probably by far the most lethal technological advance of the time, and the one that was the most murderous, one might say, was the development of the rifle to barrel. All the generals used on both sides had learned their tactics in the Mexican War, which took place only 15 years before, and they continued to use the same tactics throughout our Civil War. But what had happened in between the two wars was the development of the rifle barrel. Now, this was an advance. I won't equate it with nuclear weapons, but it was a signal advance in the technology of death, because it meant that those old long muzzle-loading rifles with the barrels rifled so that the bullets would spin, it meant that they were effective at about 500 yards instead of at about 200 yards. Well, with a muzzleloader, you can only get off 3 shots a minute if you are really a trained soldier. And so you can see that if the weapon is you can hit the guys farther away, and then they got to start from farther away, you can get more shots at them. And so the kind of frontal assaults, the battle line, so-called, where they line troops up elbow to elbow, that had been successful in the Mexican War because charging troops could overwhelm defensive troops who could only get off 3 shots a minute, you see. They weren't able to do that in the Civil War, and the net result was that they were just mowed down in many cases. Then you combine that with a lack of technological progress, I think you could call it, which is to say that medical science had not begun to flower as it has in the last century. And the surgeons of the time knew, by comparison to today, very little about amputations and how to treat wounds. They knew almost nothing about what we would today call antisepsis, sanitation, nutrition, all that sort of thing. And so not only were the troops mowed down on the battlefield, they were mutilated on the operating table. They were victims of disease in camp. They were fed badly. And many died of malnutrition, that sort of thing. Just every way you can think of to kill people, just about, they did it in that war. It was a very brutal and bitter war. But and one other dimension as to ethics, to what extent it was the ethical questions were debated in that war, I don't know. But it is true that the American Civil War, while it was in many ways the last medieval war, the last black powder war, for example, and so it also was the first modern war, and in one signal fashion, and that was it became a war in the end against the civilian population. I spoke a while ago of the devastation of the South, and that had a lot to do with it. Sherman, General Sherman, the great Northern general, I think probably the greatest general of the war, and just in terms of military advances, if anything military is in advance. He had the vision and saw that the way to end the rebellion and to end it soonest was to attack the South directly in its homeland, in its crops, in its fields, in its civilian morale, everything else. Therefore, what followed, what developed certainly from that insight, was Sherman's march through Georgia and then north through the Carolinas. And laying waste to the countryside, and that was something of a new development in war. Not that countrysides hadn't always been laid waste before, but to do it deliberately and on purpose in order to attack the war making capacity of a nation, rather than simply a fight between the two armies. That was a new development in warfare, and we've seen where that's taken us today, and the possibility of doing that so far advanced with aerial warfare. And then with nuclear weapons.
What was the press coverage like? I'm sure whatever available articles there were about the Civil War you've read.
Yes, there was very good press coverage, particularly in the northern papers and in some of the southern papers. They didn't have anything like the communications that we have today, so it wouldn't be as instantaneous often. And the writing, the Civil War reporting, while some of it is brilliant, still it tended to be much more ideological, you would say, than reporting is today, even though, as you know, we're accused of being ideological today, but nothing like that. And also great sort of flowery writing, a good deal of that. But generally speaking, the war was pretty well covered, particularly for readers of the great northern newspapers in New York, Cincinnati, Philadelphia. They all had very strong newspapers. And to a considerable extent, the Civil War helped to develop the modern newspaper that we have today, because by the end of the Civil War, almost all American newspapers, at least the large ones, had abandoned the practice of using the front page for ads. The front page became a news page. They had developed bureaus, correspondents. They sent photographers to the field. Civil War is quite well photographed, you know. And so a lot of the development of modern journalism, modern American journalism, stems from the Civil War.
Well, I'd like to talk to you about modern journalism, and my guest is Tom Wicker, who is a syndicated columnist. His column originates at the New York Times. It's called In the Nation. He's also an associate editor of the Times. His latest novel is set during the Civil War, and it's called Unto This Hour. In your memoir on press,
yes,
you dated the beginning of the modern press or modern attitudes toward the press to 1964 at an event that you were at.
Can you describe
that and why you think that's the beginning of the modern press?
Well, it was. I was referring in that book to the Republican National Convention of 1964, the convention which nominated Barry Goldwater. But at that convention, General Eisenhower, the former president, made one of the major speeches, and in that he attacked the press. Now, I've forgotten the details, but my recollection is that General Eisenhower, who did not have any great animus against the press or anything of that sort, in fact, had been very well treated by the press over the years of his fame, my recollection is that he'd been irritated by something that Roscoe Drummond, the columnist for the New York Herald Tribune, had written. Anyway, he attacked, I can't remember the full quote, but he attacked, quote, sensation-seeking columnists, unquote. And this was before the Republican convention had nominated Barry Goldwater. And those people went nuts. They went crazy. They started jumping up and screaming and cheering and shouting and throwing their hats in the air. And you've never seen such a demonstration. It was truly spontaneous. And I'm not overstating it very much when I say that those of us who were sitting there in the press box, quite exposed, you know, we thought they were going to come over the fence after us. I mean, my point in using that as a starting point is that I think that was the first time that it became obvious, and particularly to the press, that there was a lot of hostility and animosity out there towards the press. I think a lot of that really stemmed from television, much more so than from the printed press. But nonetheless, we're all in the same basket, so to speak, on that. And I think not only has the press been conscious of that ever since, but a lot of political figures and just the public in general found. I mean, from that point, the whole question of the American press has been one of considerable debate in our country, and it's been advanced. That debate has been advanced, or heated up, one might say, by press performance in Vietnam, which followed very shortly after that, by the press performance in Watergate. There's been quite a generational change in the press in the last 20 years. Reporters tend to be young anyway because they run out of gas after so long a time. But the political press, and particularly the national political press, tends now to be much more nearly your generation than mine. There's a big change. And people who came to their adult consciousness in the 60s moved into the press. All of these things have changed the press considerably, and consequently has changed the public attitude towards the press.
Do you think the public still distrusts the press?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's a question of... There are many things about it, and when I say that they do distrust the press, by that I don't believe, for example, that you could submit that part of the First Amendment, which protects a free press, I don't believe you could submit that to the public and get it repealed. But I think that the hostility is there, and it's a very healthy and natural thing because it acts as a very fundamental check on the press. I've told the story many times, and I think it's true, that when we published the Pentagon Papers in 1971 and the government got an injunction and imposed a prior restraint on us so that we couldn't publish, by every measure we had, we felt public opinion on our side, but because the government had silenced the free press. And people felt very strongly about that. Americans, I think, are properly suspicious of unchecked power, and they felt that the government had used its power in an unchecked fashion here, and they were on our side. And then we won the case and could resume publication. And it just, it was like night to day, we felt public opinion turn around because all of a sudden they saw that even the government couldn't do anything about the arrogant press, which can go ahead and print anything it wants to. And I think that's a healthy reaction on the part of the public. And as long as the press is free, and as long as it does even a reasonably good job, and I would say that that's about all you can say for the American press, that job is going to be disturbing to people. It's going to disclose things that in many cases they'd rather not know, as in Watergate, let's say. It's going to shake their confidence in institutions and in processes. To the extent that we go behind the press releases, so to speak, and say, you know, what the president just said is not true, or the governor or the senator or someone, that people may want that kind of a checking process, and I think they do, but at the same time it's upsetting, it's disturbing to them. So for that reason, I think there's a lot of hostility and distrust of the press, and then a lot of it is not so salutary for the press, too. The fact is that the press is not as accurate as it ought to be. If you've ever had a news story written about you, as I have, you know how that feels when there are inaccuracies about you all over the press. The press tends to be careless of people's reputations. Some of that is unavoidable because you're investigating a story and people unavoidably get in the way of it, and they're hurt by it. Nevertheless, they are hurt. Sometimes they're hurt when it need not have, when it's not necessary. It need not have been done that way. The press is, I think, inexcusably unwilling to concede error. Once an error has been made, to concede it and to make a handsome reparation for it. We just don't like to admit that we're wrong anyway. So there are a lot of reasons why the people dislike the press that aren't very complimentary to the press.
I'm sure you've been asked this a million times, but I'd really like to hear what you think of the philosophy of objectivity, if you think it's attainable, and if there are values that you would follow instead of objectivity that mean similar things but not exactly the same.
Well, I mean, objectivity is a great ideal to shoot for, but I prefer to use the word as a goal for the press, and one that I think is attainable, and one that I think by and large we do attain in most things. I prefer to use the term even-handedness. I don't really believe anybody's objective. Everybody looks at the world out of eyes that have been shaped and trained by your experience and by your parents and by your interests and whatever. You can't be totally objective about things. If your son or daughter was in that medical school in Grenada last year, you probably felt somewhat differently about that invasion than someone who had no such personal connection. So I don't really believe objectivity in that sense is possible. People like to think somehow that the press can be a sort of a truth machine, like the AP ticker, you know, just turn out the truth. And that's really not possible. But what is possible is for reporters and editors to be and broadcasters to be even-handed about what they do. Now, I know this is possible because whatever my critics may think, I can do it. You can do it as a reporter. Any number of people can do it. That is to say, I may be, let us say, quite opposed to some political candidate. I may be opposed to him as a person, as an American, as a voter. But if I have to write a story about that candidate's campaign, I'm perfectly capable of being even-handed about it. That is, that not to let my animus or my bias show in here, not to slant the facts, not somehow to put a knife in that candidate's back or something of the sort. And so I think even-handedness is attainable. I think it usually is attained, although there's some regrettable slips. But objectivity, you know, the very process of a newspaper, every step of it is subjective. If you're an editor and you send a reporter to cover this story and not that story, that's a subjective decision. And it's like that all the way up to the top.
When you're a national reporter, as you've been, particularly when you're covering Washington, as you did, you're given the official line from the government, from the president or secretary of state or whoever. What's the responsibility, do you think, of the reporter after they've gotten the official government line?
Yeah. Well, I object a little bit to the term official line because our government is so sprawling and contradictory in so many cases that there really is not too often an official line. Now, this administration, the Reagan administration, has succeeded better than any I've seen in controlling information to this extent, in putting out a more or less unified approach to the news. Except that there are always an awful lot of leaks out of that White House. But the reason you don't really have an official line in this government is because you can never quite get everybody into line and agreed on one thing. If you're mining the harbors in Nicaragua, there's always somebody who knows that and who's opposed to it and who's going to go and leak it to Jack Anderson or something of the sort, you know. So there's never really an official line. But the White House, the State Department, the Pentagon, they all do put out official statements and even, you know, speeches and that sort of thing. And there's a quasi-official line on, you could say, for example, during the long controversy when the question of deploying missiles in Europe or of negotiating a treaty with the Soviets on that question. The official line, repeated from top to bottom, ad infinitum, from the president right on down, was that the Soviets would only negotiate seriously once we deployed missiles in Europe and they knew we meant business. Then once they knew we meant business, they would negotiate seriously. Now, you heard that 1,000 times. It was repeated and repeated and repeated. Simply wasn't true. And it's been shown not to be true. Instead, the Soviets broke off the negotiations, and there's no likelihood that they're going to go back to them anytime soon, maybe not at all, with as long as President Reagan is in office. So it's statements like that that it is necessary, I think, for the press to try to analyze, to try to get behind. And even though you can't actually disprove a statement of that kind, because the president was perfectly entitled to believe that. Perhaps he did believe it. I'm not charging him with insincerity on that. Nevertheless, you can marshal up arguments why that might not happen. You can put the pros out there beside the cons, so to speak. And that is, in a sense, what I mean by being even-handed. Now, in the old days, and by that I mean roughly prior to the war in Vietnam, which changed so much in American practice, in the old days, a statement like that by a president would hardly have been challenged at all. And that was, generally speaking, what was meant in those days by objective journalism, capital O, capital J, objective journalism. What that really meant was that the president would make a statement and you would carry it in full, and at most you might go and get the minority leader of the Senate, the opposition party leader of the Senate, to make a counter statement, and you'd put that in there somewhere, but that was it, and you didn't really go behind it. I'm not exaggerating too much when I say that. Now, you would make a much greater effort actually to present an even-handed picture rather than just assuming that the president, because he said it, it must be right, it must be true, and it's objective to present what the president said and let it go at that. Now you would much more nearly try to, as I say, get up, see if there are opposing arguments, see if there's a logical fallacy in this, see if there isn't some reason to suggest to the public that it might work out differently.
You've written that presidential press conferences, particularly ones today, are frequently a better tool for presidents to manage the news than they are a tool for reporters to get at previously undisclosed information. How do presidents use press conferences to their own advantage?
Oh, there are any number of ways. In the first place, the president can and does make statements at a news conference and then not really take any further questions on that subject, you know, so that the idea that somehow the press is grilling the president there is not often true. Sometimes it's true when a president will let something go, let a real discussion develop about something. But if he doesn't want to, he doesn't have to, is my point. And a president often comes out and makes an opening statement about taxes in Central America, whatever it might be. And while the questioning attempts somehow to get behind that opening statement, you never do because it's got the advantage. You know, it comes through and people hear that. That's one way. Another way is that news conferences are so they're considered headline news nowadays, rightly so, that presidents can make misstatements of fact or statements that aren't exactly dead on, you know, that are to their advantage, shape the statement in a way that's to their political advantage or diplomatic or whatever. And reporters will dash for the phones, and that's going to get in the paper before it ever gets caught up with. Now, 2 or 3 days later, somebody might, like me, might come along, you know, in a column and say, now, hold on here, wait a minute, it's not quite so. But it's too late by then because the headlines and the TV and the radio, is the president has had the first impact, and it's hard to catch up with that. There are other ways they use news conferences to their advantage. I remember being told during the Kennedy administration that President Kennedy used news conferences when he had an internal argument in his administration. Pentagon wants to do this, State Department wants to do that, you know, back and forth. And it's hard to settle those arguments because one side, they never give up. You know, President Kennedy would sometimes go before a news conference, the whole public is watching, and state that he's going to do a certain thing, thus settling the argument, coming down on the State Department or the Pentagon side, whatever it might happen to be. And having said that publicly, then he could say to one side or the other, well, you know, I can't change my position now. It was an advantage to him. There are many ways in which presidents use news conferences, but the main one is the main advantage it gives them is in their ability to shape the news to their liking. To tell President Reagan, for example, can come out and picture the situation in Nicaragua as he wants the public to believe it. Here again, I'm not being entirely cynical because I'm sure that's the way he believes it is. But it's happened in the past, we know, and no doubt in this administration too, that presidents have sometimes rather deliberately misstated the news in order to get the political advantage of doing so, or just to bring the public along in the way they want them to go.
Well, when you are a Washington reporter, you are actually approached to plant a question for the president at a press conference.
Yes, that's not uncommon at all. Now, when I say that's not uncommon, I mean it didn't used to be. Whether this administration does it or not, I don't know, because I don't personally go to their news conferences. Even by now, it seems to me that it's more important to see what the public sees on TV than to be there in the room, you know. But anyway, in the past, that was a practice, and I'm sure it still is. And there are some reporters who see nothing wrong with that, that a president, rather than coming out and making a an opening statement, let's say, would rather have it appear that he's been questioned on something and has given an honest answer to the question, you know. So they'll plant questions, and I can't say that that is a reprehensible practice in that sense, but I do think that reporters should maintain their distance from political officials that way, and there's a little too much collusion in that for me, even though the planted question may elicit a useful answer and one that I agree with. I just would rather maintain my distance in a way and ask my own questions.
Syndicated columnist and New York Times associate editor Tom Wicker is my guest, and the occasion for his visit is the publication of his latest novel, which is called Unto This Hour, and it's set during the Civil War. Reporters are very dependent on their sources to get more information, and a source can threaten to dry up for you if you don't give them the kind of coverage that they want. Is there any blackmail like that going on?
Oh, sure. Access is the lifeblood of journalism, and if you're a reporter assigned to cover the State Department for a big paper like ours or the Philadelphia Inquirer or whatever, you're expected to be able to get a phone call through to the Secretary of State every so often, or to the Undersecretary, or whoever you're not over there just to take their handouts. Well, depending on the Secretary in whatever department we might be talking about, they can make you pay very dearly for access. And you're not put there, after all, not to cover the news. You've got to get access to an extent to cover the news. On the other hand, I've seen it. I think reporters very often pay far too high a price for access. And sometimes just going beyond just access to being able to have an interview with the Secretary of State or whoever, actually wanting to be on friendly social terms, in kind of a close social footing and so forth, you know, and feeling that being reporters, it's very easy for reporters in Washington to get to feel they're part of the government, really. Even though maintaining a journalistic position, they feel somehow that they are really on a equal footing with the cabinet officers and the members of Congress and so forth. And in a sense, I suppose they are in terms of relative importance. But I think that's a deadly attitude for reporters to take, because once you begin to feel that you're part of the system there, you know, part of the apparatus, so to speak, why then to a large extent you are. And I think on the whole, reporters can function pretty well in Washington just by being first and foremost knowledgeable about the subject they're supposed to cover, by having a reputation for earning a reputation for presenting what you know and what you're writing about honestly and accurately and even-handedly, a reputation for hard and honest work. For a good publication or broadcaster will get you more access than all sorts of currying of favor.
Does a president's personality ever determine the way the press treats that president? Like, if they're nice and cordial to the press, are they more likely to get good coverage?
I think so. Of course, that's a thing you can never prove, and very few people are likely to admit, you know, that they gave favorable coverage. And in fact, I think it's a much more subconscious process than it is any kind of a conscious decision. But I don't think there's any doubt that, you know, the press reporters who covered him generally liked President Kennedy. And he got, on the whole, pretty good coverage. He didn't think so, but he did. Reporters who covered him generally did not like Richard Nixon. He didn't like them. Very unwisely on his part, he let that show. He almost picked fights with reporters. They were only too happy to fight with him. He got bad coverage.
What do you think of Reagan's coverage? And his?
Well, I think Reagan has gotten off light. Carter, for example, Carter got, I wouldn't say bad coverage in the press in that sense, but the press certainly didn't like him, and they didn't give him much of a break. And in all honesty, he deserved some of that because he didn't much like the press either. And he didn't suffer fools gladly in any case, and he tended to regard reporters as being fools, and they aren't in most cases. And so Carter, I think, got a less favorable press than his record might have warranted. Reagan, on the other hand, who, if I may say on this program, I don't know how nonpartisan you're supposed to be. It's my opinion, not the station. I think Reagan is a very bad president, He's ignorant and ill-informed, in my judgment. But at the same time, he's a very likable chap. And most of the press, they rather like the guy, even though many of them at the same time really don't have much admiration for him as a president. And I think that has affected the coverage he gets, which is not very severe by comparison, let's say, to what President Carter got or President Nixon. And I'm talking about before Watergate, in Nixon's case. And I think there's another factor at work, though. It's not just the mere affability of Ronald Reagan. I think that the press is intimidated to some extent by Reagan. He won what appeared to be a landslide in 1980. It was a landslide in the Electoral College, if not in the popular vote. And that surprised the press, not that he won, but that he won so big, carried the Senate in with him and so forth. And I think that intimidated the press, as it intimidated Congress. In both cases, I think they thought, well, this man must know something we don't know here in Washington. And indeed, that was true. He knew something more about the temper of the country than they did. But I think that both Congress and the press were intimidated by that, and they thought, well, you know, the country's on this man's side, and we better go light here. And that's why Reagan got his big tax bill through so quickly and got off to such a good start with Congress, because they were rolling over and playing dead in a way that they don't do today. And Congress very much influences the press. 535 members of the House and Senate, and that's 535 news sources down there, and they're constantly talking to the press. And if they're saying, gee, this Reagan is a tough guy, he stands tall, he's really pushing those bills through here, then the press is going to take note of that. If, on the other hand, they're saying this guy's a real klutz, you know, they'll take note of that. So I think those factors have been involved, and I do think that President Reagan, considering that Soviet-American relations are at the lowest ebb, at least since 1962, the most dangerous ebb, considering that we have no nuclear arms control talks going now, and that not least of the reasons for that is the intransigent position that this administration has taken about building up the nuclear forces. I think we are risking a war every day in Central America, a war that you might think would not be. I mean, so what's a war with Nicaragua? Well, a war with Nicaragua could be a long and costly and bloody guerrilla warfare that in the age of television could tear this country apart again the way Vietnam did, which could bring tremendous pressures on countries like Mexico that are very important to us. And so I think that's a risky and dangerous, not to say reprehensible policy, is that too. And we have suffered under Reagan a setback in Lebanon that would have got many a president impeached. The loss of 262 Marines, which an investigating committee of his own Defense Department said couldn't really be justified. And then the subsequent pullout from Lebanon after all that. When you look at all of that, that's my judgment. When you look at all of that and then see that Reagan is still getting a pretty soft treatment in the press, then I think that it is true that somehow, I've just given you my analysis of why it is, but I think the press is not borne down on him the way I've seen them do in presidents in the past, notably Johnson, Nixon, and Carter.
What kind of coverage do you think he should be getting that he's not?
Well, I just think that there ought to be more analysis and more commentary and more editorials about these things that I just mentioned a moment ago, and that news stories ought to be written not in a some slanted fashion, I'm not saying that, but they ought to be written much more in the consciousness of this kind of thing. I mean, I saw there was a particular example I saw this morning in one of, and I believe it was in the Washington Post. Could have easily been in our paper, but it was in the Washington Post, I think. News that a destroyer has been sent down to cruise the, or two destroyers have been sent down to cruise the Gulf of Fonseca off the coasts of Nicaragua, Honduras, and El Salvador. And I can't quote the lead exactly, but it said this destroyer had been sent down there to help stop the flow of arms from Nicaragua to El Salvador. Now, that lead is written out of the assumption that there is indeed a flow of arms from Nicaragua to El Salvador. And in fact, that question is very much in doubt. I've been down there and I've talked to the military officials, American military officials, and they can't cite you the evidence for that flow of arms. It is unquestionable that the El Salvador guerrillas get most of their arms from the El Salvador army, which comes from our stocks. So all I'm saying is, not that somebody doesn't send an occasional case of arms over there. I'm not saying that there is, but that story was written in the assumption that Reagan is right, that the El Salvador guerrillas are getting all their weapons from Nicaragua. And I think we just see too much of that in the press today. And it was particularly notable, because this was a subject I paid close attention to, in the long process of trying to negotiate restraint on missiles in Europe. And I paid a lot of attention to that, and constantly, day after day after day, news stories were written in the assumption that Reagan's proposals were right and in the American interest and in the interest of peace, without any real questioning of whether, in fact, that was true.
Well, this brings to mind the question of how much time reporters have to actually check the information out that they're given. Because if the government tells you that Nicaragua is providing arms to El Salvador, well, that's a really hard question to...
Yes.
Research for yourself. You
well,
need a lot of
right.
time and a big travel budget. And
but that by now, there's been a great deal written by a lot of people who've been down there, who've talked to the military on all sides and so forth, so that you shouldn't be just making that automatic assumption anymore. But your point is very well taken. And reporters, we are hampered by the dailiness of things. You hardly get through with today's story before tomorrow comes rolling in on you, and you have to deal with that. You don't really have time to absorb the news before there's more news. And I think also reporters tend, and this is understandable, and there's almost no way around it, but reporters tend to a great extent to get their news and to get their education in a given subject from their news sources. If you're covering the Justice Department, you get what you know about the criminal justice system from people in the Justice Department, and that inevitably has got a certain slant on it, a certain warp on it, because they're responsible. And reporters don't have the time or the inclination or both to get out and go to independent sources, to adversarial sources, adversarial to the government, in the case of nuclear weapons, to the any number of scientific organizations that are available where you can get other information. Reporters either don't have the time or the inclination. In any case, they all too often don't do that, and therefore they really are just passing along what they hear from their news sources.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Wicker, associate editor of the New York Times, columnist, syndicated columnist, his column's called In the Nation, and author of the new novel Unto This Hour, which is set in the Civil War. I just want to read some news that we got from our wire service.
Oh, please.
I don't know if you've heard this yet or not, but we've just found out that earlier today, David Kennedy, the son of Robert Kennedy, was found dead in a Palm Beach hotel room. He was 28 years old. And there's no official cause of death which has been announced. There will be coverage of this on this evening's edition of All Things Considered, which begins at 5 o'clock.
That's a dreadful story.
Yes, it is.
That family has been plagued with the most incredible series of tragedies.
Yeah. Well, there'll be more news this evening at 5 o'clock on All Things Considered. And if you're just tuning in now, my guest is Tom Wicker. I'd like to hear about what the transition was like for you when you changed from being a reporter and Washington bureau chief to being a columnist, because the nature of your writing, your ability to use your own judgment and opinion, of course, really changed.
Yes, it did, as it would for anybody in that circumstance. Reporters for the news columns are basically limited. I don't think they're as limited as many of them let themselves be, or should be. But you're pretty well limited to reporting as accurately and as even-handedly as you can what other people said and did. And you can increasingly, in American journalistic practice, bring some background to that and try to put it in perspective for readers and everything. But still, you basically, your charge is to tell people what happened yesterday and what was said yesterday, and to do that as honestly and as accurately as possible. The columnist, the opinion commentator, doesn't really have that charge at all, because you assume that the public knows what happened, unless you come up with some scoop story of your own. And the columnist's charge in that case really is to tell the public what he thinks about these things. And it's assumed that he's been around long enough, that he's had enough experience in government and politics or whatever his particular field is, that he's competent to offer an opinion. And that's very difficult for the trained reporter, to accept that attitude, because when I first began writing a column, it was very difficult for me to shake out of the view that my job was to call up some government official and say, what ought the public to know about this, and then to report what the public official said. And to get around to the point of trying to tell the public what I think about this, you know, and what perhaps other people that the public's not hearing from. I report a good deal nowadays on defense, nuclear weapons questions, and I try to get outside of the Pentagon and the generals and so forth and go to scientists and go to others who study this matter. There are a lot of strategic experts and that sort of thing around. So I try to do that because the public's not getting that. Or not to to a sufficient extent, but the task of switching over from telling the public what other people said and did to telling the reading public what you think about certain matters, what your views are, what your attitudes are. It's a hard adjustment. It really is.
Do you think
a lot of people don't never think you ought to make it? They think that even a opinion columnist ought to just stick to kind of a recitation of unchallengeable fact, you know.
Do you think of yourself as wanting to convert your readers to your viewpoint?
No, not really. And I don't think you can do that. I hear a lot about how powerful the press is, and I think that the press is powerful in terms of headlines, and Woodrow Wilson said the news is the atmosphere of events, and I think it's powerful in the sense that we do a lot to color that atmosphere, you know. But the press can't send troops to Vietnam. It can make the public, or it can lead the public towards a certain attitude about sending troops to Vietnam, but it can't do it. And I never feel that I have the power or the capacity really to affect great changes or to elect candidates or defeat candidates or pass bills or anything like that. I not only don't think I have that, I wouldn't want it if I did have it. If I wanted to do that kind of thing, I'd be a politician. They don't have all that much power either, but you certainly don't have it in journalism. And I think that the best that you can do with an opinion column, and I would like to think that sometimes I do it, I think that you can be provocative in the best sense. That is that you can state a case in such a manner that people will think about it. They don't necessarily agree or disagree or whatever, but they will think about it. Maybe it's a perspective that hadn't really occurred to them before. After all, those of us in this business are supposed to be sort of trained, experienced observers, and it should follow that every now and again we know a little something that the public who are not in journalism don't know. So maybe you can put it in a different perspective for them. Maybe you can tell them something about Nicaragua that they really didn't know. Any number of things you might do so that they will think about that subject in a different way. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they would change their minds. In fact, I regard it, if somebody comes up to me and says, God, I really disagree with that column of yours this morning, that's fine with me because I at least know that person read it, thought about it, had enough interest in the subject to disagree. Of course, I'd rather they'd agree, but I feel that what I'm trying to do is to make people think about things, and at best, perhaps in some way they hadn't thought about it before.
There's been a lot of developments in the function and nature of newspapers since you started writing, and I'm thinking
indeed.
Of a lot of them closing down, for instance, of the function being fulfilled by television, not fulfilled in the same way, but people maybe turning in to see the TV news and not spending that much time with the newspaper, newspapers not doing very well, and now national newspapers like USA Today, and more and more chains buying up newspapers.
A lot of changes, you're right.
Do you think that the newspapers in America are weakened from these changes? Because there's a lot of speculation, newspapers are going to go under, people are spending much more time with television.
Two ways to look at that. I think that the newspapers that survive, and there are many, of course, in fact, at a smaller below the metropolitan level, it may even be more than there used to be, in a sense, because you don't have the technological problems of producing them now. It's much easier with computers and that sort of thing, much less expensive. But the newspapers that survive today are, by and large, I think, stronger than they were 20, 25 years ago, unquestionably. Fewer newspapers survive. The afternoon newspapers in particular have been hard hit. And newspapers have had to adapt in a certain way to the fact that the public does get its news primarily from broadcast sources now. what has really happened, I think, in a simplified analysis, the broadcasters, particularly the TV, have taken over the front page. I mean, that's where you get your headline news. I think Walter Cronkite used to say that his half-hour program wouldn't fill more than about half the front page of the New York Times. But that's where you get your headline news, and I think, by and large, they do a pretty good job. I'm talking mostly now about the network news job. I don't have that high regard for most local news stations that I see. And that has meant that the Times or the Philadelphia Inquirer, we just can't anymore assume that what we put on our front page is just going to hit readers between the eyes. You know, oh, my God, look what happened yesterday. They already know when they pick up the morning paper, you know. By and large, they already know. So it means that we've had to go a step beyond that and try to tell people more nearly what it means and how it happened and so on. And I think that strengthened newspapers by and large.
Well, I wish we had some more time to talk, but we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for spending the past hour with us. It's been very interesting.
Well,
thanks
thank
for
you.
Being here.